Hi, I'm Lyman, and I would love to give a warm welcome back to my good friend Marcel after his week at Merlefest.
Hey, you can't see me right now, but right now I'm doing the like clasp hands where you shake them on either side of your head. And that's a bad description of that motion.
That's the best description I've ever heard of it.
Anyway, yeah, I had a great time at the festival. I'm super glad that you got someone awesome like Miles to sit in. So that was great. I'm going to be honest, I only listened to like half that podcast because I love the sound of my own voice. So I really only listen to podcasts that feature me.
Anyway, this is our podcast. Jazz and grass and other stuff too. Yeah, how was Merlefest? Like, what was your favorite part?
Well, it was awesome, dude. I mean, basically, there's a ton of like bluegrass heavyweights, is what I like to call them. That just these great players that have been around for forever, and I haven't seen a lot of them because, I mean, I haven't been in the scene that long or been in North Carolina very long, so I haven't had the chance to, I don't know, seek these people out, actually see them live. So it's kind of a weird experience. There are all these people that you've watched on YouTube and you've seen do all these things, and then suddenly you're like right in front of them and you're like, oh man, you're a real person. So yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. I've been feeling a little sick, a little under the weather, so if my voice sounds weird, there you go. But yeah, I think we're fine here.
One thing I wanted to touch on, like, I totally don't go see a lot of live music. Like, in the past, like, 5 years, I've gone to maybe one or two concerts with, like, quote-unquote big-name people. One of them was Real Big Fish. Like, that was a real surreal experience for me because I grew up listening to Real Big Fish. Like, oh, I started listening to them 03, 04. And I went and saw them in 2015, 2014, or something like that.
How was that?
It was a lot of fun. Like, I joined the Skankin' Circles. I was dancing around like a madman. Of course, I was drunk off my ass. but yeah, one of the openers they had was really, really interesting. They're called the Maxis. I think they're still making music. They all wear like Mexican wrestling masks. They opened with that Ramones song, but instead of the actual words, they said, "Hey, hoes, let's go. Hey, hoes, let's go."
Oh man, that's my culture. Those are my people.
I think they're like actually from like Iceland or something. I don't know.
Man, you know what I did notice, just swinging it back around, was that in the beginning of your podcast, you guys were speculating about why it's called Merlefest. And it's actually a super cool story, and I would love to tell it. And by super cool, I mean really sad and kind of gruesome and bloody. So anyway, there's this guitar player named Doc Watson, and Doc Watson is a really big deal in the flat picking community. He's blind, and he started learning fiddle tunes on acoustic guitar, and he's one of the first people to do that. And he gets really popular kind of during the folk revival scene, you know, like in the 60s or so, which means that we didn't have any lead bluegrass guitar until that point, which means that it's the last instrument to develop too, which is really interesting. But anyway, he did a lot of touring, and he did a lot of touring with his son Merle. And Merle was a super cool dude too. I mean, they're both just great players, and like their shows are wonderful. You can find them on YouTube. But anyway, yeah, Merle one day is he's unable to sleep, so he's awake at night. I hope I tell this story, by the way. I'm not reading it off anything. And he gets up in the middle of the night to go work on some siding, I believe, for his house. He's working on some trim or something. So he goes down to the basement and he starts working with this saw, cutting this stuff up. And so while he's cutting it alone in the middle of the night in his house, you know, some like wood splinters off or something crazy happens, and he ends up with a big old piece of wood embedded in his forearm, I believe. And so he has no idea what he's going to do. I mean, he's like bleeding out and he's freaking out. So he gets in his tractor and he drives to like the neighbors where they have their lights on. He like knocks on their door and he's like, "Hey, look, I'm dying." And they bandage him up. They get him all set and like good to go. And they just send him on his way, which seems absurd, but he was kind of a manly dude. So I'm sure he's like, whatever, I can take care of myself. And he gets back in the tractor, and no one knows exactly what happened here, but he ended up, like, fainting, or the tractor misfired, or he ran into a ditch, or, like, some horrible stuff happened when he's just out, you know, from blood loss, just all woozy. And he ends up going through, the way I've heard it told is that he ends up going through, you know, where the windshield would be if tractors had windshields, and the tractor continues over, and the tractor crushes him. And, you know, no one finds him till the next day. And that's how Merle died. And so Doc was so distraught because, you know, that was his kid that he toured with, that he starts this whole festival named after him. And now the festival scope is much larger than bluegrass, but it's crazy. So, you know, for instance, at the festival, there's a lot of, I don't know if it's in good taste or bad taste, there's a lot of tractor-related stuff that happens, which is kind of a funny little way to remember him, I guess, because it's the thing that killed him. But like in the front of the festival, they make a giant sand sculpture that's got like Doc and Merle and some other people on top of a tractor. And yeah, anyway, just a crazy story.
Yeah, that's very sad.
There's a lot of that in bluegrass. Like, people just died in crazy ways. The other, you know, famous bluegrass guitar player right after Doc is probably Clarence White, before we get Tony Rice. And Clarence White was like beheaded in a parking lot.
Really? Is that an accident or, like, intentional?
Yeah, it was a total accident. It was part of a car accident, but just Jesus Christ, right?
Wow. I had no idea about that that side of things in bluegrass. I mean, feels like when jazz was happening, people were just dying of, like, heroin overdoses.
Hey, that's pretty cool too. Don't knock dying of a heroin overdose. That's like maximum cool, right? We should all just do so many drugs.
Yeah, Clifford Brown's story was really interesting. I heard he was a sober guy. He wasn't into drugs or anything like that. And he died at the age of 25 in a car accident. And he only had like 4 total years of recordings, but he's had a huge influence on like all trumpet players. So that was the one like jazz death that stood out in my mind. There's probably a ton of others, but
yeah, there's so many to talk about. Yeah, there's some famous murders and stuff that happen to bluegrass musicians, but that's not really what this podcast is about. That's a great idea for another podcast, though. Famous deaths and music. So why don't you tell the people what we're actually talking about today, Lyman?
Yeah. Today we're going to talk about just some stuff that we wish we knew, or concepts we wish we had or had a better grasp of when we were starting, when we were coming up, to kind of help the younger generation, you know, get to where they're going to be quicker.
Yeah, this is kind of like that podcast we did a couple ago that was about, I don't know, things that you use when you're beginning but you don't really understand. I don't remember how we phrased that exactly. But yeah, that's we're doing something a little bit similar. We're talking about just like all the things that we personally really messed up and what someone should have like slapped us and told us.
Mm-hmm, for sure. One thing I wish I knew was that there were different positions for pitch collections, for scales. And honestly, until like about a year ago, I only used one pentatonic position, the classic one. That was my grasp of how the pentatonic scale was. I didn't know you could finger it. And it was actually watching one of Marcel's lessons where I learned about the different sort of boxes. And I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. but that pretty much worked for all of my scale patterns. I only knew like one real major scale pattern. Well, two. Starting on the E string and one starting on the A string. And there were two octaves, but like that really locked me into some odd ways of phrasing and getting out of lines and improvising and stuff like that, because I knew some arpeggios and some different positions for those, but if I wanted to do like a major scale sort of line, it was real difficult for me if I wasn't in one of the two positions I knew.
Right. Yeah. So you're, I guess what we're getting at is like, how would you fix that? Right. So if you went back and you talked to your young self, you would be like, man, learn all those pentatonic boxes and go learn your major scale and all those other shapes.
Yeah. Like, the exercise I was talking about last week, the one with the melodic minor, four notes per string. That's helping me a lot as far as being able to grab more notes in whatever position I'm in. And you can start that by, you know, two notes per string, three notes per string, just starting on all the different scale degrees. I mean, you can think of that as modal practice, like starting on the two, you're doing Dorian. I just think of all the modes of the major scale as just the major scale. But there are more positions, as I'm discovering recently.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get trapped in places that you like feel super comfortable in. I just remember, like, I feel like I learned all my pentatonic boxes fairly early on, but there was a lot of stuff that I learned in specific boxes that I never moved to other boxes, and I think that was my big hang up for a long time. I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't thinking about the neck in a full kind of way. I was like, oh yeah, there's this one spot where you can do this idea. Now realizing that if there's one place you can do it, there's probably five other places that you can do it. So that's how the guitar works.
Yeah, that makes total sense. What do you got? What do you got for me?
Yeah, so I think the, you know, my biggest hang up, you know, playing bluegrass was, you know, there's a really big speed element. And, you know, there's tons of great players that just can't keep up because their technique is holding them back in some way or, you know, whatever else they got going on. But, you know, the big thing for me, what was holding me back for the longest time was actually how I held my pick. And if you have a pick handy, I can show you how I do it. Yeah. You know, basically you you take your index finger, your middle finger and your thumb, and like a claw, you just grab onto that pick. And why it's horrible and why it doesn't work, and if you do it, you should stop immediately, is because it kind of puts too many muscle groups in control of the pick. So, like, already when we, like, you know, play the guitar, we kind of have, like, our elbow, or rather the forearm rotation. You already have your wrist, and now we have your thumb, and you have two other fingers that are also in control. So there's so much going on. There's so many different ways you can now move this pick and like orient it in some kind of specific way. You think maybe that would be more useful, but this isn't like, you don't want this to work like a fancy claw machine or something. Like the actual motion of picking a string actually takes a lot less, and you get a lot more control if you hold a pick the real way, and you know what I call the real way. Basically, to do that, you just make a fist with your thumb kind of on the outside there, you just slip the pick in. And I mean, after that, you can relax your hand. You can have open fingers if you want to. A lot of people do. But when you have your hand like this, there's a lot less muscle groups involved. In fact, a lot of the control of the pick is in your forearm and your wrist now, and there's nothing else kind of messing it up front. You get a lot more just like stability in this pick grip. Suddenly there's like there's a lot less muscles keeping you from messing this up in some way.
Yeah, for sure. I do use a little bit of finger muscles to kind of angle my pick, a little bit of thumb. I was trying that claw grip, and it just feels like my forearm is doing a lot more work. That's probably unnecessary.
Yeah, you can, I mean, whenever you want, you can kind of take stock of what your arm is doing and which muscles are engaged or which muscles aren't engaged. And, yeah, a good way of just seeing if you're making something harder than it has to be is doing that check-in and seeing like, oh, do I have like a ton of muscles engaged everywhere? Like, you know, is my body tense because I have so much going on? And in reality, when you hold a pick, you know, using the fist kind of motion, not a lot has to be engaged here. Your hand can be very relaxed like that.
Yeah, like, I mean, this isn't really a technique episode, but my general philosophy on technique, again, is just relax as much as possible. Like, just be relaxed.
Yeah, totally. You know, kind of with that, I feel like the posture thing was a tough thing for me, too. You know, in bluegrass, you're playing big D-sized guitars, and it's really easy to try to want to be lazy. I just cracked my back because I'm like thinking about it now, but it's really easy to try to be lazy. I actually hurt myself really bad in the wrist one time when I was practicing something. I was practicing a weird repeater too. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I was like leaning back on my couch, so like reclined, and my hand was kind of bent, my fret hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I could still play the guitar, but it was kind of like lazy in my lap. And I was doing something hard, like something difficult. And I did it, you know, for like a couple hours straight. And then like the next day, my wrist was so messed up. And we even canceled a gig and I couldn't play for like a month. I just stopped playing because I needed to heal. And it's the only time I've ever, you know, really hurt my body from an instrument is, you know, that stupidity. And I realized like, oh, wow, like I'm not playing easy stuff anymore. Now that I'm playing hard stuff, I should probably like play guitar in a serious manner, sitting correctly, etc.
The general rule of thumb, if it hurts, stop. Like, just stop. Mm-hmm. If you get any sort of inkling of pain, like, put the instrument down and go do something else. Like, literally anything else. Because you don't want to aggravate any injuries. Just got to shut it down. That's going to be one of my big things moving forward with this podcast. Don't hurt yourself. Don't get hurt. So if it hurts, stop immediately. Yeah. But
what else you got going on?
Now that I'm off my tangent, one thing I wish I worked a little bit more on was I just realized I said moron because I'm a moron. would be chord voicings, and clearly, like, I've been putting in a lot of work with voicings. Like, every time I talk about what I'm working on right here, it almost always has to do with voicings. But I knew like four voicings. I knew this one, I knew this one, and I knew this one, and this one. So I figured, I know all of the chords. There is no reason for me to ever learn any more chords. I can just concentrate on single note lines. Like if I want to make this into a seventh chord, I got that. Cool. Don't have to learn any more chords. But recently, like I've been finding like interesting voicings can lead to interesting single note lines. Like, take this minor seven voicing. You can use voicings, the interesting ones, in different sort of permutations to create new lines. I've been doing that a lot with the sus7 chords and the major7 sus2 chords. Like there are always more voicings to learn, and especially as a jazz player, like I did not pay enough attention to that like through the first like 8 years of playing the guitar. Try stuff out, test out different voicings, try moving your hands in different ways. Don't stretch yourself out too much as far as like the physical aspect, but just start putting your fingers in places that you wouldn't normally expect and see what you come up with. I'm not sure I've ever played that chord before, or let's see. I've never played that one before, but just try different stuff out. Like, the voicings don't end at just major and minor bar chords. There are so many ways to play different chords, and it also helps you sort of get out of the way of, like, other things that are happening if you're playing in a larger ensemble. Or if you're playing, you know, as a duo, you can use larger voicings to make things sound more full. But, yeah, I really wish I put more time in on that in the beginning, because that's where a good chunk of my practice goes today.
Yeah, I think that you kind of pointed out something cool there, too, with you know, with the idea of letting the chord shape lead your soloing, because if you're, I don't know, there's kind of this expectation of you should be able to do everything in every place on the neck. And I don't think that's bad. I think that's good. You know, I already said that I think that's good. You should be trying to put everything everywhere. But I also think that it's really important to kind of develop kind of a mindset or an approach or a feeling towards certain parts of the neck. And they can be weird. They can be, there can be, you know, no reason for them. A good example is if I'm, you know, if we're talking about, like, for instance, the pentatonic scale and, like, adding notes to it to make it seem more embellished, like that fifth box, your symmetrical box. If I'm in the key of G, that's 10, 12, 10, 12, 9, 12, 9, 12, 10, 12, 10, 12. That box, in terms of, like, adding new things to it, always feels particularly, I feel like the things that I want to add to it are kind of altered extensions. It feels very jazzy to me. It's not a box that I feel particularly, like, rock and roll about or, like, bluesy about or, like, anything else that comes out. You know, but of course, if we talk about where, like in G minor, that box one would be, of course, you know, that's always going to feel kind of, you know, bluesy or rock and roll to me. Well, but, you know, if I take maybe like box four, the one that kind of exists around a C shape, that's the one that would start in the key of G. It would start 7-10, 7-10. That one feels really major scaly to me. Something about how it's laid out, you know, I don't know, I'm just more inclined to do that. And, you know, that doesn't mean if I was in that spot, I couldn't make it feel, you know, bluesy or rock and rolly or whatever I wanted it to, or certainly jazzy. But, you know, those places in the neck still have, like, opinions for me. I still have a way that I feel about them. And they're informed by the chord shape or by the scale shape, you know, just how it looks. I have an opinion now. I don't know why.
Yeah, like, voicings can inform your lines. And that's super cool to me. It kind of unlocked a bunch of new possibilities for as far as lines go and creating lines, especially for our Lick of the Day Instagram. Like, it's hard to come up with a new lick or a new batch of licks. What do I play? Like, I play this all the time. You grab for a line or a voicing and play, like, that was just this voicing. Like, it just leads to new possibilities, and you can really, really start, like, improvising with those things.
Yeah, totally. A lot of my licks on our Instagram are mostly about connecting different shapes for me. So it's about, like, you know, the idea of having to travel the neck, you know, creates interesting circumstances where interesting licks come out, you know. So, you know, I have a chord shape here and I have a chord shape there, and how can I connect the two? And, you know, how can I make the travel in between interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what it's all about.
What else you got?
Yeah, man, I kind of continuing with the lead concept thing. I feel like what messed me up a lot, and it's funny because this is how I still teach people when they start, but there's a big difference between creating, like, a linear line that has, you know, kind of all neighboring notes, and then creating something that's much more that has some more jumps in it. And you're landing on chord tones and you're playing enclosures and stuff like that. And you know, for the longest time, I was really bad at that kind of playing because I just didn't understand how it worked. So I would take something like I don't know. I would take like a if I take like a circle of fifths kind of progression. If I have like A7 and like D7, initially when I wanted to play over those things, I would just create linear kind of lines. I would create, you know, stuff like that. Not that that's bad or anything, but it, you know, it doesn't really nail the feeling that I'm trying to put out there versus something like, I don't know. You know, where there's a lot more jumps that are landing on different chord tones and like they have more arpeggios in there. And of course, these six jumps, which are so kind of point out so much about that like bebop sound and creating bebop lines. But man, I wish someone had just like said that to me in those simple terms, because, you know, all of the work that I did trying to like play jazz or even just trying to play over circle of fifths progression was all creating these like stupid lines that were just like bop, 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 bop. And they're all just like notes that are next to each other, like, you know, within half steps or whole steps of each other. And what I actually needed to do was like create more arpeggios and more acknowledging and more acknowledging of the chord tones. And now I feel like I can do a lot more of that. But back then I was just such a jerk about that kind of stuff. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people do that when they start playing jazz. That's not something that makes sense. What's the kind of advice that they give to people where they talk about like arpeggio one way and then like scale the other way?
I don't know the word for it, but I know what you're talking about.
Where they're like, you know, create an arpeggio going one way and then like create a scale going the other way. You know, to like create a line that's not super boring.
Yeah.
maybe I should have done more of that.
Arpeggios and like enclosures, like it's a real big part of the bebop language, and it's something you might not necessarily grasp if you don't like listen to a lot of the you know, great bebop era musicians. But like I love enclosures. I use them all the time. That's one of my favorites.
It's amazing how much different it is when the bluegrass guy plays jazz and then when the jazz guy plays jazz. Man, it's like a different planet. It's almost like we hired you to do this or something.
I'll play some bluegrass licks soon on this podcast, and then everybody can laugh at me. It's gonna be funny. Yeah, enclosures, man. They're dope.
This is your smooth transition into you talking?
Yeah, this is my smooth transition.
You're killing it right now.
I am crushing it on this podcast. Tone. How to tone. Like how tone.
Oh,
works.
That's easy, dude. You can. If you ever need tone, you can just borrow my Telecaster and that should do it, right?
That's how tone works.
Buy a telly.
I didn't understand how tone worked for the longest time. Like, what it was. Like, I saw these knobs, like tone knobs. I didn't really know what they did. I just knew it sounded a little different.
One of the tone knobs makes it get quieter too.
That's the knob that everybody says I should use. But it wasn't until I started like actually working in like electronic music that I started to like kind of get like what tone was like. The difference between I encourage everybody to take a listen to the difference between a sine wave at 440, a sawtooth wave at 440, and a square wave at 440. And they all sound different. And there's a reason why they sound different. The sine wave is just a single tone, one fundamental, no harmonics. The sawtooth wave has all the harmonics in the harmonic series. And this is sort of what the harmonic series is. But those upper sounds are contained in like an open E string. There's some of this going on, a little bit of this going on, a little bit of this. And to me, tone is how harmonics behave. Like the decay time of certain harmonics, what harmonics you're filtering out, what harmonics you're accentuating. Like, all distortion really does is add higher harmonics in an interesting way to kind of expand the harmonic spectrum. Make your sound a little bit more full spectrum rather than just like a fundamental. The way I get my jazz sound is I take out a lot of the higher harmonics. It's pretty much mostly fundamental, the first harmonic, and like the second harmonic. Like once you take a look at the harmonic series and like analyze other instruments and how they sound and how their harmonics behave, you can start to manipulate things in interesting ways. Like my favorite thing for tone is a parametric EQ. Like being able to control what parts of the spectrum are louder and what parts of the spectrum are. But I'll include some examples. They're not going to be guitar sounds. They're just going to be synth sounds of like different sort of tones and a little write-up with each one of like what's sort of happening, why the thing sounds like this. To me, tone is just trying to capture what the harmonic content of your instrument is doing, and not like harmonic content like as far as like chord changes or anything like that, but the actual harmonic series and the ratios that create them. Adam Neely's got a ton of great videos on like harmonic series and stuff like that and the ratios. But once I really understood that and like understood the equalization spectrum, 20 hertz to 20 kHz, like and figured out like how to manipulate certain parts of the spectrum, that's when I understood like how to get the sound I wanted.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of that applied to I don't know, when I started recording stuff, I feel like I made a lot of mistakes, and I guess this is my last point here, but you know, when you go to record something, there's this feeling that you want every instrument to sound this certain way and the fullest it can possibly be and so on and so forth. And then you put all those sounds together, it sounds terrible and everyone's in each other's ways and there's a big problem going on. And it's kind of a similar thing as to what you're talking about. Basically, you know, you can manipulate, how busy the harmonic structure of a recording is, you know, after the fact. And you can mix that with other instruments to make things fit together a lot better. You can also, you know, do that and mix it with other instruments and make it sound a lot worse if you don't know what you're doing. But, depending on the genre, you have more or less problems. You know, if you take like a classic rock band, you know, your drum set is going to cover the entire frequency range, but you know, what's going to hold the most kind of weight to the drum set sound is probably going to be your kick and your snare, which are going to dominate more of your, you know, low end and more of your high end for the kick and snare respectively. And then you take like a bass player, you know, in the real classical sense, the, you know, the bass drum should be lining up with what the bass player is playing, right? And they're going to exist in that same frequency range. They're going to get a real, you know, heavy sound. And then your lead guitar or your vocals are going to take up your high range. Then you have a rhythm guitar to kind of fill out the middle. If you just record all of those sounds and you try to make them sound as beautiful as possible and you put it together, everyone's going to be in each other's ways. But for instance, if you take a rhythm guitar and you chop off the high end or you chop off the low end, and then once again, you can sweep through that spectrum and you can find where there might be like a point that's too like harmonically busy or something, and you can take that down. You can create a rhythm guitar that sits well in the mix. You know, that Rock Band example is actually pretty simple. It's pretty easy to create that and not have too many troubles. When you get into a lot of these genres that didn't really have a specific recording tradition, you have more problems. Like if you take a bluegrass band, banjo, guitar, and dobro, and upright bass all occupy some of the same frequency spectrum. So that means you have, what is that, four instruments that will be right on top of each other. I mean, there's nothing, they're literally right on top of each other. And so trying to create them, you know, working together in a mix, it's really something interesting. You know, people should be playing smaller chords or staying out of the way, or dobro players, for the most part, should probably just not be playing unless they're doing interesting fills or something, because you're just, you know, having two people strum and it's creating a bigger problem. And then, you know, if you look at the other instruments that we have left over, you have like fiddle and mandolin, which are tuned exactly the same. So they are the same instrument, you know, talking about what frequency ranges they take up, and they have to occupy that same range too. So just, oh, it's just a mess, you know. So I wish that I'd understood all of that about, you know, kind of mixing things and recording things. And I'm still learning a lot about it and still trying to kind of execute that in a proper way. But man, compared to my early recordings, my album that I put out recently, it just sounds so much better just because I understood how that worked.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult concept to grasp. Like, I've recorded things for like the past 8 years, and like in only the last year or two, I've created anything sort of listenable. And I'm glad you our last two points like kind of coincided with each other, because there was something I forgot as far as like frequency spectrum and and sound, like the way you actually like attack the instrument and do certain things, it's going to have an effect on the tone. So essentially, it's going to have an effect on the harmonic content. If you play with the thumb, you're probably going to get a more defined fundamental, less higher frequency content. And the closer you play to sort of like where the middle of the string is, like, and I use the term string, like, from the point your finger is on to the bridge, that becomes the string for the sense of this analogy. If you play towards the middle of the string with your thumb, you're going to get a more pronounced fundamental. If you play with a really hard pick towards the bridge, you're going to get more high frequency content pronounced. And there's all sorts of different spots in between, and they create different sort of low and high frequency content at the very beginning of the note, the attack. And all that stuff can be classified as tone. So that's another thing to think about, like how you actually play the instrument, because mm-hmm. tone is, a lot of it's actually in the hands. Like, I put a lot of processing on my guitar, but I was demonstrating for a buddy the other day. I'm like, oh, the processing does everything. And I played two different guitars. And there were things that I expected that didn't change, and things that I expected that or didn't expect to change that actually did. I had a lot of tone in the hands, and like actually the guitars I was using was changing, had something to do with the tone a little bit. But don't discount what happens like with your hands and with your technique, because that has a very big effect on your sound.
Yeah, it's you know, what I was thinking about when you were talking about that was me and Lyman both spent time playing upright bass with groups, the double bass, if you will. And the first step of the harmonic series is an octave, right? Then after that, a fifth, so on and so forth, right? Yeah. And if you've ever played an upright bass, you know that it actually gets really hard to discern some of the lower pitches. And actually, when they're, you know, recorded and processed and everything, a lot of times what you're actually hearing is that first step of the harmonic series, mm-hmm. which I always thought was really interesting. And that, I guess that happens with a normal bass too, but it's something that's kind of imperceptible. It's not like when you go down to that low string, it's so low that suddenly it sounds an octave up. But, you know, it's somewhere in how we perceive it and how we like adjust to that sound, we're taking on more of that first step of the harmonic series. It's weird.
Psychoacoustics are crazy, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the bass usually sits for me like mostly in the low mids, not in the quote unquote lows. That's where you hear the bass. And if I'm in a live setting, like playing bass in a rock band, I would rather feel the bass than hear the bass. That's just how I like to do things and have things done to me. I like to feel the bass.
For anyone who's playing dumb things musicians say bingo at home, be sure to cross off your free square, of course. But also, Lyman has recently said tone is in the fingers, and he'd rather feel the bass than hear the bass. So that's two squares that everyone should have crossed off.
I don't know if anybody that listens to this knows this, probably, but I'm actually primarily a bass player. That's what I do, like as far as my performing goes. That's where I do 90% of my work. But I just love playing guitar and getting better at guitar. But I'm primarily a bass player.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So cross out the third square. I'm primarily a bass player.
Yeah, man. That's great. Yeah, just leave it in the comments down below if you get a bingo.
you will win something. I'll draw a picture. I can't draw. I'm going to cut this out.
Me and Lyman will draw a picture together. Lyman will start it, and then he'll mail it to me. I'll finish it, and then I'll mail it back to Lyman, and then Lyman will mail it to you.
Yep, that's how it's going to work. Guess I'm not cutting this part out.
Oh, man. Anyway, you want to get into our repeating segments? Oh, hey, speaking of segments, man, we forgot a segment in the beginning. Let's talk about what kind of cup Lyman has today. Oh, man, what kind of cup is that, Lyman? Why don't you tell us all about it?
It's blue. It's like baby blue, and it's plastic, which is what my wife buys because I am very likely to break glasses. Funny story, like the very first podcast we recorded, I had an actual glass, and as soon as we were done, I got up and just kicked it over and just shattered it all over the floor of my apartment. So I've decided to go plastic for the rest of these podcasts, and promptly told my wife she was right to not trust me with glass.
That's so good, man. Yeah, I don't think we've talked about it before, but normally behind Lyman, there's also a large bag of goldfish, and I don't see it today.
Nope. They're in my belly.
You finished the goldfish. Man, it's like everything's so different this podcast. That's what happens when I miss one episode. Suddenly the goldfish are gone.
Yeah, I got really hungry the other day.
Anyway, man, let's get into our repeating segments,
yes.
Huh? So I got a really interesting one here. So The first segment we like to do here that we do at the end of all our podcasts is what we're listening to and what kind of is inspiring us right now. And I recently made this friend, and kind of a weird story. He left a great comment on my YouTube channel about something that I should do, and I ended up making that video, and I did it under a time crunch too, and it was a fun little thing. You're welcome to check it out. But it I ended up emailing with this guy over and over again, and I noticed that he was only responding to my emails very late at night. And I was like, man, this guy must, like, I don't know what's going on. Like, why is he always up so late? Maybe he works like a weird shift or something. And eventually he's like, oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm in Germany. So I made this bluegrass friend in Germany that's very, very knowledgeable. And I guess I still don't know if he's German or American or what, but he speaks very good English in any case. And he's been sending me all of these really good resources. And he's been sending me these, like, long booklets about, like, you know, chord melody stuff, and then, like, these arrangements of tunes, and just, you know, these lists of, like, players I need to check out. So he's just a really cool dude. But one thing he told me about was this guy named Russ Barenberg, which is a player that I was already vaguely familiar with. Like, I knew the name and everything. I knew he was a flat picker. But apparently there's this band called Country Cookin', which I find so lovely. Country Cookin' is... what a name, what a cheesy name for a bluegrass band. And they did a bunch of, like, jazz fusion stuff. And there's this song called String Song that this guy in Germany gave me the tab for. And the break is just incredibly hard. It's so hard. Like, just looking at the tab, and this rarely happens to me, but looking at the tab and listening to the music and, like, reading along, I got lost a couple times, and I had to, like, restart. Yeah, which is just hilarious because, like I said, that's not my thing. And so I started playing it, and I can only play it just so, so slow. And I can't wait to work this thing up just because it's such a cool little piece of, like, how jazz should be played in a bluegrass setting. Anyway, yeah, Russ Barenberg, Country Cookin', String Song is the artist, album, and song. There was a recording of it on YouTube that I found. It's also a very rare recording, but I tried to find it today, and I couldn't find it again. So good luck in tracking it down. I know the guy in Germany that pointed it out to me says he's got it on an LP, so I'm not sure they ever printed it on CDs, so you're out of luck.
Digital age, folks. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I am one of those people.
Yeah, go to your local record store, pick up the LP, and you're good to go.
So in other words, me, Lyman, is never going to hear that song. What's a record?
I don't know. What's a record with you? That joke doesn't make sense with the word record. That wasn't good. That wasn't funny. You can cut that. Feel free to cut that.
A record with me is I once ate two Little Caesars pizzas in one day. That's a record with me.
Wow, man. That is a hell of a record. I can't. One time I ate an entire box of corn dogs, like the, you know, the kind you, like, stick in your freezer, mm-hmm. you know, like those microwave corn dogs, because I was finishing a bet in which I couldn't eat meat for a month. And so on, like, the last day at midnight, I was just, like, craving corn dogs. I don't even like corn dogs. I wanted a corn dog so bad. So I ate, like, you know, I don't know, 20 of them or something. And I threw up all night.
Oh.
Anyway, let's move on.
You got me wanting corn dogs, man. We're not moving on. I'm going to talk about corn dogs for 15 minutes.
Yeah, man. Why do they pump cheese into some of them? I feel like that's so weird. That's not my jam. Like, I just want your, you know, run-of-the-mill corn dog. I got opinions, and I'm ready to talk about my opinions.
I want
to
choose what sorts of sauces, like, I put on the corn dog. Like, cheese on a corn dog sounds great, but I want to dip my corn dog in cheese.
Yeah, I want that to be my choice.
But I've been listening to some stuff too, as well. Not nearly as interesting as yours, but I've actually been listening to some of my own music that I created. I do this project where I release 2 lo-fi hip-hop tracks a week, every Tuesday and Friday on SoundCloud. And I've been wanting to talk about, like, why I do these. One reason is, like, you know, the production, like, just getting my production chops up. But another reason is, like, I make these as, like, backing track play-along things. I've been trying to use a lot of, like, non-functional harmony and trying to play over these weird changes or completely disregard changes. I've been listening to that and just kind of analyzing how I approached certain things. Like how I approach weird changes, like this going to this, or like just chords that shouldn't go together. Like I just finished like a batch of like 18 of these, so I was kind of like burned out. Now I'm just listening back and like analyzing what I did, because in all honesty, I have very little recollection of what I did. I just, oh, chords done, cool, move on. Bass done, cool, move on. Guitar solo, let me try that again. Okay, cool, done. And that like 18 times in a row. So it's real interesting. It's like, I know it's me playing, it's my sound and it's how I play, but there are tons of spots where I did things that I wouldn't like normally expect me to do, and so that's real interesting to look at. I don't know.
No, it's cool. It's something that we don't get to do enough as like improvisers. I know that I don't get to see enough footage of myself like playing in a show or anything, so I can listen back to it and say like, oh, you know, that was good or that was bad, and get to like critique that kind of stuff. But it certainly happened to me where, you know, like, for instance, I remember one time my girlfriend was watching a video on her phone, and it was a flat picking solo, like bluegrass stuff. And I was like, oh, cool, that's good. Who is that? And she was like, that's you. That's you playing that. That's from the show like 2 nights ago. And I was like, oh, damn. Well done. I don't remember that. I don't think I've ever played that before. That doesn't even sound like something I'd play. I was ready to be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna write that down. Like I should steal that from that guy. And it's my own playing.
That reminds me of another story about your girlfriend's phone and a video she had on it for a very long time. Of me, like, and the upright bass, it just drunk off my ass, like falling over, like still trying to play. You remember that one, right?
Yeah, I do, man. That was good. There was, that was during, I had like a Christmas tree up, yeah. Right?
And my fiance at the time, my wife, I heard she was coming over, and then I don't know why I was outside for some reason, but I saw Marcel talking to this tall blonde girl. I'm like, my fiance is here. And I just run up to her and give her like just a great big hug. And then I pull back and I'm like, you're not my fiance.
That is brilliant.
So I don't drink alcohol anymore.
Yeah, that's good. You kind of, you had that like little kid at the grocery store moment where you like, you're like looking for your mom and like haircut matches, shirt matches. Yeah, that's my mom, but it's not. It's like
that's exactly what happened. It reminds me of that How I Met Your Mother game. Drunk or kid?
Yeah, that's great, dude.
But yeah, like.
Anyway, let's talk about what we're working on right now. Yeah, what we're studying.
For sure.
So I've been doing this. I'm not sure if we talked about it on the podcast, but I think Lyman has said he does something similar. But a lot of times when I like, a lot of times my like best practice time is before I fall asleep. So, you know, I like to like lay down in bed and just like, you know, kind of obsess, you know, think about, you know, whatever I'm working on or try to work out some new scale shapes or some new chord shapes or whatever it happens to be. Anyway, what I've been doing recently, though, is I've been trying to run in my head before I go to sleep as many fiddle tunes as I can. So it's like running through all the repertoire I know and make sure like I know all the chords and the melody and trying to play the melody in like, you know, at least two places. And oh, God, it's been such just like a cool and hard exercise too, especially with trying to get the melody out in a couple different places, you know, trying to use as many open strings as possible and all of that stuff. But I think it's really easy to like learn a lot of tunes and like think you know a lot of tunes really well. And then, you know, what happens is when one of those tunes get called in the jam, like you start playing it and you're like, oh, yeah, that's the one that like I kind of just half learned. And sometimes it's not a big deal. I mean, sometimes you just blaze through and it sounds good anyway and no one can tell. But just I'm basically doing like a cleanup process where I'm like, man, I know so many fiddle tunes. There's like, you know, hundreds. And now, like, can I just try to go through them and do like all of them that I can and like make sure I know the chords and like try to play the melody as true as I can, of course, all in my mind. But when I go to bed, I've just been picking like a letter of the alphabet. So I've been like, all right, you know, like B's. What are all the like B fiddle tunes I can do? And I'm like, Big Sciota, Beaumont Rag, Blackberry Blossom, you know, like Big Ma, and so on and so forth. And I'm trying to get through like all of my B tunes. And then I'll pick another letter and be like, all right, what are all my tunes that like start with that letter? Can I do all of them?
What about X?
I don't think I have any X tunes.
We know the same number of X tunes.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like there's... actually, you know, it's funny that I said B because there's a ton of bluegrass songs that start with the letter B. There's other letters that are just, like, not represented. I mean, like E. I'm trying to think of, like, bluegrass tunes that start with E. Elzik's Farewell. I don't know, man. Someone else is going to come up with a good one, and I'm going to be like, oh, I didn't think of that.
Let us know if there are any bluegrass tunes that start with E or X. All right, I discovered a new voicing type this week, not surprisingly. I call this the Lydian chord. Got like a major triad and a sharp 11. So it has the natural 5 and the sharp 11 in it. And Without the natural 5, like it could be a flat 5, could be a sharp 11, you don't know. But with the natural 5 and sharp 11, I call that chord Lydian. So I've just been taking this shape and doing all the inversions of that. I especially like these two voicings. With the minor second. And so I've been trying to find different ways to like sort of resolve that, like as far as like a 2-5-1 goes. Like interesting. But my study with the Lydian chord led to another chord type that I'm really digging on right now, and I call these the whole tone chord, the whole tone chord type. So I'm playing E flat Lydian. This voicing I have G, B flat, E flat, and A. If you move up the B flat in all of these voicings to B, you get a chord made out of 4 of the 6 notes from the whole tone scale. so you can move those up in whole steps, and essentially you have the same chord. But I started checking out the inversions of this chord, and I showed this chord showed up, which is one of my favorite chords of all time. I think of that as sort of like F7 sharp 11. You can use like any bass note from the whole tone scale, and essentially you have a dominant chord, kind of like an augmented dominant. But the other voicings are these guys. So I've been trying to use the Lydian chord and the whole tone chord in a 2-5-1 progression. So I'll just play like a F minor 7, and then this whole tone chord, and then a Lydian chord as the major chord. And I've also been doing exercises trying to move the whole tone chord down like a whole step or a major third, and use a different inversion each time. So yeah, the Lydian chord is a major chord, or you could even think of it as like a minor six chord. At C minor 6. And the whole tone chord is a dominant chord. Has led me to different possibilities as far as like voicing my 2-5-1s, my 3-6-2-5-1s, just all the common progressions. It's interesting, it's fun. I love that Lydian sound.
It sounds very much like film score stuff. They always use Lydian in
yeah. Like did movie you themes. Did you catch what movie theme I just played?
Oh man, it's so familiar.
I'm pretty what sure that's Lord of the Rings.
Oh yeah, that is
like I may have got it wrong, but
I was thinking of the beginning of the Back to the Future theme.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Are we gonna get a cover of that soon?
That was dope.
But yeah, Lydia and whole tone chords. I'll include a tab and notation for those, and a couple examples as well of 2-5-1s. But yeah, fun stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome stuff, dude.
Do you have anything else?
No, man. I think we hit all the highlights. We talked about the cup. We talked about the corn dogs. I mean, what else do you need, right?
I think we said we were going to cut a bunch of stuff out, but I think a lot of it we're actually going to leave in. The cut it out podcast, yeah, but actually leave it in special. I don't know. Anyway, I'm Lyman Lipke. You can find me at LymanLipke.com for lessons and all the other places I'm available online, like Facebook, SoundCloud. I kind of have a YouTube channel, but not really, not yet.
My name's Marcel. You can find me all over the web. It's all branded at Lessons with Marcel. So you can find me on YouTube, of course. That's the big place. And then you can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. And you can find me on Twitter. I highly recommend you check out my website, lessonswithmarcel.com. There's a bunch of free stuff on there. And that's also where you can sign up for Skype lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I got.
We do this thing together. It's called Jazz and Grass. It's a new lick every single weekday. And we used to do two on Wednesdays, but I think we're moving that to Fridays.
Yeah, it looks like we're doing two on Friday.
And you can find us on Instagram at Jazz and Grass. And we're just about to hit.
Oh, yeah. Hey, we... Yeah, I was going to see if we hit it during the podcast. We didn't, though.
I've been checking like every 5 minutes.
Right now we're at 495. Before we started recording, we were joking about maybe that we would hit it while we were filming.
Yep, I guess not today. It's not in the cards, but thank you so much for listening, and we will see you guys next week.
Yeah, see you later. Thank you.